All right, 6:16 on this 10/24/24, October 24th. Going to be warm, highs in the lower 80s. It's going to be that way for the next 10 to 12 days. No cold weather for Halloween. They were saying on the news last night that it was hot, rather cold and chilly and breezy last year for Halloween. I'm trying to remember that, but I honestly don't. Was it cold for Halloween? Maybe because I didn't go trick-or-treating or anything like that, and my kid's 28, and that's, you know, those days are gone. Anyway, we're going to talk to Todd Bentzman, Senior National Security Fellow at the Center for Immigration Studies, to talk about his trip to Mexico. I don't know if something went wrong in the southern Mexico at the border, and he's still locked up, or I don't know. I hope everything's all right, but I'll ask you in the meantime. You can text me at 504-260-1870 to talk about what you think. The situation is at the border. The stats, the numbers show that arrests for illegally crossing the U.S. border from Mexico fell 7% in September. That's more than a four-year low. It was likely the last monthly gauge during a presidential campaign. And Donald Trump, we all know, has made immigration a signature issue, a huge signature issue. So I would ask you, is that like really the thing at the top of the list when it comes to presidential election? What is at the top of your list? What is your major concern? Mine is stability and continuity of government. And also when it comes to the race in the Senate and the House, the races in the Senate and the House, what is anybody going to do about debt and deficit and Social Security and the massive, serious problems that are facing this country? And is anybody going to work in a bipartisan effort to try to assist them? And I'm more concerned also about, will the next president, will the next Congress, will the next Senate, House of Representatives put country ahead of party? And I would ask you at 504-260-1870 to share your opinion on that. Do you think that the politicians today, the people in Washington, would ever put country ahead of party? Or is it all about being reelected? And if it's all about being reelected, you better fall in line with the party, or else you're going to be primaried or you're going to be facing some other challenge. So this too, I thought was interesting. Elizabeth Francis, the oldest living American, died at 115 years old. She was originally from Louisiana. And I thought about living to be 115, which is a long way away for me. But how old would you like to live? Would you like to live to be 115? Or 100, or 90, or 80? Just a quick survey here on the Oakland Heart Jeweler Talk and Text Line at 504-260-1870. How old do you hope to live? And apparently this lady was within, you know, still had her faculties and everything, understood what was going on. And I guess it's all about the quality of life that you have as opposed to the longevity of it, because some people at 60 are disabled and not having a great time of it. Other people are 100 and moving around like crazy. So let me know, 504-260-1870. A couple of things for you to comment on. What is your major concern when it comes to the presidential race? Are you going to vote personality? Are you going to vote party? Are you going to vote issues? And if you're going to vote issues, what is the issue? And how concerned are you that anybody, whether it's the president or whether it's a representative or whether it's a senator, that can work together and actually put the security and safety of the country, both militarily, financially, socially, in every way, ahead of partisan politics? Because I don't see it, which doesn't portend well for the future. We'll take a break now. Traffic, WWL 620. Well, I'll tell you what it is. It's the fall. It's the event of the season, and it's the annual fall savings event at my boy Troy Duhon's premier family of dealerships. He has finally gotten the inventory you've been waiting for at all of his dealerships, and you got a selection like none other. If you've been waiting for the right time to buy that new vehicle, the time is N-O-W, which spells now. Premier's cutting big discounts. The lenders are ready to approve with competitive rates with little or no money down. And remember this, when you purchase a new vehicle in one of the Premier family of dealerships, it comes with a free warranty for life. And if you buy a used car from Premier, all of them are Premier certified, they come with a 3-day money-back guarantee. You don't like it? Bring it back. They'll take it back with no questions asked within 3 days of purchase. Again, you're going to want to hang on to your receipt. Coming up on Saturday, November 16th, it's the annual Giving Hope Gala. It is an incredible event. Troy and Tracy Duhon put it together with incredible entertainment, great auction items, and special guest Ms. Gail Benson. And that's November 16th at the Hilton Riverside. You can find out more, get your tickets at givinghopegala.org. If you want to volunteer at a food bank on either the East or West Bank that Giving Hope has, please go to givinghopenola.org. Both are great opportunities for your kids to get some service hours for school if they need them. You can shop online at premierdreamsanddriveways.com at all of the dealerships, and you can prepare yourself for your transaction and or either sell your car, see what your trade-in's worth, or outright sell your car at premierbuyscars.com. Now, if you want to do it the old-fashioned way and head to one of the dealerships, the weather's great for that, too. Head on out to Toyota of New Orleans, Premier Honda, Premier Nissan of Metairie and Harvey, Premier Kia of Kenner, Premier Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram, Premier Hyundai of Harvey, and Premier Volkswagen of Harvey. And please, if you can, go to givinghopenola.org. All right, here we go, 625. We're going to talk about the border with a guy that visited Mexico from the southern border, but apparently a hard time getting him. I hope he's not in some Mexican prison somewhere. We hope the best for him. Let me read some of the texts, and then I'll play a soundbite for you from the campaign. Somebody texted and said, if Kamala Harris is elected president, will Russia really take back Alaska? I don't know if that's supposed to be a joke or not. Someone else said, you say you want stability and continuity of government, but what has stability and continuity got in the Saints? A dumpster fire. Well, you're kind of ignoring the injuries there, but okay. Debt, deficit, and Social Security top risks. That from Steve in Metairie. But you know what, Steve? Is anybody addressing that? Are you listening to anybody, or rather, are you hearing anybody seriously address that? Because I'm not. It's all about, you know, no taxes on this, no this, that. And I'm promising everybody everything for both candidates, and all that's going to do is increase the debt. As far as how old do you want to live, somebody said, I'll be 70 next month, and I hope to live to be 71. You know what? You got to have realistic goals. I tell myself and all my friends every day I'm going to be 120 before I consider dying. I would ask you this. Have you ever considered actually that you're going to die or not? Or is that just kind of some abstract concept to you? I expect to live actively at 100 to 120. Healthcare keeps getting better and family has longevity. This text about immigration says 20 to 40 million people have invaded this country across the southern border. Absolutely, crossings are down. Most of the people that want to be here are. Another one says protection of our fundamental constitutional rights and protection of the unborn. Okay, let's see. Most of your listeners and voters probably don't care if a president is able to put country above party, because most voters have become just as partisan. Too many people have drunk the Kool-Aid being served by one of the two major parties. How did El Salvador, says this text, in the past 2 years reduce violent crime by historical proportions? Perhaps the violent criminals came here? Well, I would suggest you look up a logical fallacy called postdoc ergo propter hoc, and see if that applies here. What worries me also about the influx, not only for Taylor Swift, but Super Bowl, is our poor customer service mentality and training in New Orleans. Okay, so apparently somebody has a beef with what happens here in New Orleans. I want a government that's stable, exercises common sense, promotes unity instead of division, does the right thing regardless of party, puts the country first, and a government we can all be proud of on the global stage. And to give you a little taste of what's going on the campaign, we've got a couple of sound bites for you. The first one, Tim, I guess is, let's play former President Trump first. That is in relation to what John Kelly says, a New York Times interview he gave about the former president. He was former President Trump's chief of staff, saying that he fits fascist definition, prefers the dictator approach. You know, a lot of his former generals have come out against him. Former President Trump says it's sour grapes, disgruntled former employees. And I'd ask you that as well. Does that get your attention at all? Do you have any concerns that former President Trump would be, as he said, a dictator on day one? He says things and then they say that he was joking. On Fox News yesterday, they were talking about the thing with the Nazi generals, and they were trying to explain away Brian Kilmeade by saying, well, maybe he didn't know that the Nazis were bad, which kind of strains credibility. But does that factor in any of this for you? 504-260-1870. When we come back, we'll talk to Mike Strain. I know he's going to be there because Mike's always there for us every Thursday morning. We always learn something. We're going to talk about Louisiana shrimp. We're going to talk about fall. We're going to talk about a lot of stuff. It'll be fun. Stay tuned. Tommy Tucker back in a flash, WWL. 644, 16 till 7 Thursday morning. That's when we talk to Dr. Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. How you doing, Dr. Strain?
Man, I'm doing extremely well. How are you?
I'm well. I got to ask you about Hootie. How's Hootie, the new basset hound in the Strain family?
Hootie is having a great time. Hootie goes to work every day at the veterinary hospital and is the official greeter. So the day is great for Hootie. Gets to see people all day long, then come back and just chill out for the rest of the night.
You know, we're going to have to do
a good old time.
One day, your respected veterinarian, as is your wife, we're going to have to just spend a day, a morning, talking about the best dog for the best, you know what I'm saying, to meet your needs and all that kind of stuff, how you find about, how you figure out what's the best dog for you.
How you pair up the dog to the person, right?
Yeah, because you know,
doctor, vice versa.
A lot of times people see a dog on TV and they want it, and that's not the kind of dog they need at all, and then the poor thing wounds up in a pound or something else. We'll do that another day. Let's talk about the outlook for crawfish.
Crawfish outlook looks good. We've seen some preliminary discussion about up to 400,000 acres of crawfish. Now, I think that's a little bit optimistic, but if we can get up to a solid 320 to 350, that'd be great. Right now, the weather's been good. You know, it's a little bit dry right now. However, we still have enough water in most areas. The ratoon crop of rice has come along very, very well, and they'll be cutting that beginning, you know, in a few weeks, actually by Halloween, and in that week or two, they'll start harvesting that rice and then flooding the fields. So we're very optimistic. Everyone is working hard. They're anticipating a really good crawfish crop. We're going to have enough vegetation because they feed off the rice. You know, after we harvest that second harvest of rice, we flood those fields. The weather conditions are mild, and that's good. And that way we could have, the rice will break down slowly and feed the crawfish. And so we're excited about it. You know, we think we'll be watching very closely, you know, early January, what they look like. But if these weather patterns hold, if we get a little bit of rain, just a little bit, and then if we have, just mild temperatures, I'm expecting a good crawfish season. Everybody's anticipating, everybody's hopeful, and everybody just can't wait. And we're having a good shrimp season, and shrimp is available too. And so we're really working hard, and our agency is going to be moving very, very much in the way of further promoting and doing a lot more with seafood.
Yeah, tell me about the videos I saw that I guess you guys produced about buying Louisiana shrimp and the shrimp industry in general. Is very well done, Mike.
It's very well done. Miss Jen Finley, I think she has 8 Emmy Awards.
Really?
Very fortunate. She's been with, yes, indeed. She is. You see the quality. We have a professional team, and it's part of our continuing series of Crawfish Tales, T-A-L-E-S, as we tell the stories of the people, the places, the products, all things certified. And when you, just like with the shrimp, you know, we get down to the people, the culture, the whole part of Louisiana. And talking about the shrimp industry is about $800 million a year, and it's a vital part. And when you think about Louisiana, you always think about shrimp boats, you know, just like crawfish and everything else. But shrimp is a big part. But what we've got to do with shrimp, we have got to eat and really push consumption of local shrimp. We need to have shrimp boils. We need everyone to pitch in and start supporting our shrimping industry because it is dying on the vine, and they simply cannot survive at shrimp at $1 to $2 a pound. It costs more than $2 a pound for them to go out and fish, you know, and the shrimp. So one of the things with the series, and again, we're working with the Seafood Promotion Board, we're working with the Seafood and the Shrimp Task Force and others on a multi-pronged approach, and we're going to be very involved in that. And so we encourage everyone to watch those videos. We're going to be doing commercials and putting that out as well as we really enhance. And the buy local movement, you know, the certified Louisiana, that has grown exponentially in the last few weeks. We've had Community Coffee join us, Tony Sacheres. We have more than 700 companies. And so that's another way that we're going to promote all of these products is through the certified Louisiana program. So it's fun. It's exciting. And if and you need, and tell everybody, you can watch those videos. You can go to our website, Department of Ag and Forestry. We're going to be putting them out on social media and then to just general distribution. But it really touches the heart and the soul of the shrimp industry. We've done one for oysters, Robin's Oysters. We've done it for many different commodities. And I can tell you, you know, what we want to do and is build up that library of videos and then play those like on PBS, and people can see the heart and the soul of Louisiana.
Let me take a break. We come back, Mike. I want to talk about the dry conditions, both as it relates to the crawfish crop, as you mentioned, rice, how the sugarcane harvest is going, because I guess this dry weather is good for that, right?
It is good. We are rolling with harvest. Harvest is moving very well, but we need a little bit of moisture. I'd like to have a little bit more tonnage, but it is going very well.
All right, and we'll talk about burn ban. Somebody had a specific question about how do you know if there's a burn ban in your parish, when it's safe to have a fire, et cetera. We'll talk about all that with Dr. Mike Strain. We'll come back. Also, any other questions, if you have them, at 504-260-1870. We're going to talk about fall, too, in Louisiana and cold weather and all that stuff. So a lot coming up. Stay with us, 650, 10 till 7. Time for traffic now, WWL. Tommy Tucker, WWL, 654, 6 till 7. Quickly back to Dr. Mike Strain, who is always here on Thursday morning, talk about everything as it relates to the Department of Agriculture and Forestry. Somebody wanted to know, Mike, and we can fold it all into one big question if you want, about the dry conditions and the weather and what effect it's going to have on crops or crawfish, as you earlier mentioned, and rice, sugarcane, and burn bans, drought conditions, all that stuff.
Yes, it is very dry, and you can go to the drought monitor if you want to look at directly at the map. We think it is actually drier than what the drought monitor, again, is telling us, and we're working to really try to beef that up as well. My meteorology team, as well as Jay Grimes, the state climatologist, and we're really pushing the drought monitors and the drought authors to, you know, to really be accurate on this. So what we have is that we're going to see, you know, probably maybe a little less tonnage in the cane, but it's doing very well and it's harvesting well. When it's dry like this, harvest goes extremely well because the equipment can roll through pretty quickly. And so, you know, we have, you know, the ratoon crop of rice, and we also have some cotton left to harvest, but the conditions of the commodities are very good. The cotton is good. You know, the corn and the beans are very good. And, of course, the sugar, it's harvesting very well. But when it's more efficient, then that kind of compensates maybe for a little less tonnage because, again, the efficiency of going through there. So that's all good. Now, with the crawfish, I think we're going to have enough. You know, so far, you know, our water wells and our surface water, we're fine. We just got to have enough water to go ahead and get those fields flooded. So we're very, very excited about that. Now, on the other side, with the burn bans, mm-hmm. We encourage everyone, one, you can go to our website, Louisiana Department of Ag and Forestry, and look at the burn ban map. Or you can also advise everybody to contact your local fire department. You know, more than a third of the state, and closer to half, is currently under a burn ban. And what that means is you can't burn debris piles. And if you're not a certified agricultural burner, you have to contact the department and call it in. And so we're urging everyone to please be careful. We've been having some fires. The other night we had some fires in Washington Parish, and what happened is that it was from a vehicle going down the highway dragging a chain. The driver, apparently, that's what we think, didn't know it, but set a number of fires and almost burned a farm up, and we got that under control. We're having 8 to 10 fires a day. Our fire crews are gearing up because they know that these weather conditions continue, then we're going to have some problems. But again, with the burn bans and everybody working together, we can minimize these wildfires. We can hold them down to small sizes and not have a situation as we had, you know, about 2 years ago when it really, really, really got severe. So it's dry, the humidity is low, and we have these intermittent winds. But we're hoping that in the next 10 days we get some moisture, and then, you know, we can have a really nice, you know, early winter, you know, through here in some good conditions.
Mike, somebody texted about these underground fires like we had, and you had a hard time putting them out. How does something like that get started, and how big is your concern, given the conditions, for something like that happening again?
Well, and that's the other thing. You know, if you look at the underground fires, those that were in the marshes, the big ones were intentionally set. And so we have no tolerance for arson. You know, it is not okay to burn the marsh or to burn the woods or to burn the fields, by arson for whatever reason. And what happens is that when it's very dry, especially in the marsh conditions, and you don't have the surface water, it will burn the top, but then it will get down into what's called the peat layer. You think of soft coal, and it will start burning underground, and it can burn up to 6 to 8 feet down. And the only way to put that out is either you've got to flood it or you got to let it burn out. And so those are conditions you got to be very careful. Now, if there's something out there, please do not go walking out to take a look at it, because you could fall through the surface into that sub layer in the fire. And what we've done working with the local fire departments and, you know, with the National Guard is to help facilitate marsh. Those type of fires in the marshes are actually not under our jurisdiction. We are wildland timber firefighters. We work with the local agencies. And the only way to deal with that, you've got to flood it. So we will try to cut or build a levee around it and work with them. And one of the things we're talking about with our legislative friends is to acquire 8 to 10 of those great big pumps, because we have to get those from the Corps of Engineers. You have to flood them. That's the only way to get them out. And sometimes we've had it where lakes were drained for maintenance and then they catch on fire and it can burn for months. We've had them burn underwater. So that's a different type of fire that we have to fight.
Burn underwater. That is crazy. Hey, thank you, Mike, for all your time and efforts and everything else. And farmers markets are open. There is nothing like going on a farmer's market on a Saturday morning getting some fresh produce.
They got some good stuff there. Look for that certified Louisiana logo.
Amen. Thank you, sir. Have a good week and say hi. Thanks for the picture of Hootie. That dog is getting big. Quick.
That dog is getting big. Yeah, Hootie with her cousin, Mimi. Right?
Right, thank you.
You see, Hootie hard at work.
Thank you, Mike. 7:15 on this Thursday morning, 10/24/24. More of the same weather-wise, bone dry, really. And we're just talking to Mike Strain. You got to be careful if you're going to have a fire. A lot of the areas under a burn ban. And we don't want one of them underground fires again like we had last year. Remember that with all that mess? No, don't want any of that at all. So be very careful if you're burning anything and check with your parish to see if a burn ban is in effect and what you can and cannot do, and never leave a fire unattended. Martha Cagle joins us now, Executive Director of Unity of Greater New Orleans. Talk about the fight against homelessness and what's going on there with the, or what went on, I guess, yesterday underneath the Calliope I guess the Pontchartrain Expressway on Calliope Street. How you doing, Martha?
I'm doing fine, but it was a very hard day yesterday for unhoused people who were unexpectedly rousted by state police from the places that they've called home on the street and abruptly moved, even though there's an active effort in coordination with the city and the nonprofits and the state to permanently house them, and they were in process of that, and that work was disrupted. And it wasn't just limited to the Calliope corridor. Actually, it started early in the morning, and it included the French Quarter, Canal Street, Claiborne Avenue, around the Superdome. There were many, many people who were moved. I don't think the state police wanted to be doing this, but they were ordered to do so. And people had been told that they might be moved on Thursday, but instead, abruptly, it happened on Wednesday. And we heard numerous reports of people losing their medicine, losing their IDs, other important paperwork, losing their clothing, people who were mentally ill being very frightened and upset, and people being scattered into other neighborhoods. So nothing positive was accomplished.
So I'm trying to get a handle on what exactly happened, Martha, and I saw Leslie Harris on TV and we spoke to her yesterday. So they basically just moved people down two blocks or something?
Yes, I mean, I do think that the state police tried to minimize the damage. I don't think they wanted to be doing it at all. So, to their credit, I think they tried to minimize the disruption by trying to move people, you know, a distance away from where they had been. And assisting them even with moving their possessions, but because there was no notice, there were a lot of people's possession. You know, a lot of people just weren't there at the time and didn't know it was going to happen. And so their medicines and IDs and clothing were thrown away, and in many cases. So there was an attempt to minimize the disruption, which I do really appreciate. And I know the outreach workers across the city tried to comfort and calm people down. But, you know, unfortunately, many of the people who live outside, most of the people who live outside, we have found are very disabled. And many of them have very severe mental illness and are paranoid. And you might only get one chance to win their trust. And, you know, this really disrupted their trust. And when you move people without housing them, even if you try to move them to a specific place, you're going to end up scattering a lot of them who are either frightened or don't want to be in a very densely populated spot. When they move people, they kind of densely pack them into a new spot. And whenever we lose people that we have worked so hard to assess and get to mental health treatment and get, you know, most of our housing programs require documentation of disability. So you're wasting taxpayer money because we're using federal grants to fund this work. And our work has been wasted and taxpayer money has been wasted and nothing's been accomplished. And I'm sure today we're going to get numerous complaints from businesses and homeowners in other neighborhoods that suddenly homeless camps have popped up and homeless people have popped up who weren't there before but have now been moved into those spots. So
we need to take
housing
a break.
Is the solution. This is not the solution.
We need to take a break for traffic, Margaret. Martha, and I got a text here, two texts from the same number. I want you to address these because this goes to somebody that I don't think has any idea what went on yesterday. Why don't the NGOs who care so much provide a legal and safe location for these people? What happened? The state enforced laws the city has failed to do for years. The delay in justice and enforcement is the root problem. Well, I don't think they really enforce the law. I think they just kind of move, push them down a block, a couple of blocks. And we can also talk, Martha Cagle, when we come back, about how that disrupted the plan to get these people, I hate to use that phrase, but to get the people that were on the street into permanent housing because there were plans in place and vouchers, as I understand it, et cetera. We'll pick it up when we come back. There are no simple solutions to complex problems, y'all, but we'll try to sort through it with Martha Cagle, with the Executive Director of Unity of Greater New Orleans, when we come back. 721 Traffic Now, WWL. 5 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Martha Cagle, Director of Unity of Greater New Orleans, helping to house the homeless. And Martha, I read that text to you. Let me read one more, and you can respond to this as well.
Sure.
Put them in an institution, get them off the street. These programs have failed. Sorry, but I agree with the governor on this. I would find an abandoned building and open a rehab. I guess you guys have never thought about anything like that, but go ahead and address all of that, if you would, please.
Well, you know, that just doesn't work. And what we're doing actually does work, but what people don't understand is that the cause of homelessness is that we have a tremendous amount of poverty and the rents have risen so dramatically in the last couple of years. Fair market rent in 2023 was only $1,000 for a one-bedroom apartment. That was already way above the means of a lot of people, but in only 2 years, it's gone from $1,000 to $1,236. And there's a lot of people in our community making minimum wage of $7.25 an hour or slightly above. And most of the people on the street we found are actually quite disabled, both mentally and physically. So what we found is what actually works, and this has been studied around the country, is permanent supportive housing, is an apartment with a rent subsidy where the person is expected to use a third of their income for rent and the rest of it is subsidized, and a case manager, very importantly. You don't just give people a key to an apartment, but you have a case manager who actually visits them several times a week, sometimes every day, depending on how sick they are, and helps them get to substance use treatment, get to the psychiatrist, get to the doctor, because these people tend to be very, very physically ill as well as mentally ill, and help them stabilize themselves. If possible, help them find jobs, get disability benefits, get reconnected to the community, get reconnected to family, just stabilize them. And we have found that that really works well, but the problem is that there's a constant churn of people who were not homeless yesterday who show up on the street today because they cannot afford the rent. And until we address all that, because housing rent assistance is only provided to a fraction of the people who are actually eligible financially for it, we are going to continue to have this problem. But fortunately, we have a lot to celebrate in our community because we have actually put together a lot of competitive grants, and the city has put some money up, the state has put money into it, and we're all working together. But I don't think that new governor realizes the extent to which we're working together and the extent to which these efforts work. And the state is actually, through the Housing Corporation, which is a state agency, is actively involved in assisting with this. So it's almost like the state is at cross purposes with itself. And I hope the public is sophisticated enough to understand that just moving people around without actually permanently housing them is a waste of taxpayer money and is undermining the work we do, because we lose people that we've been working closely with. A lot of the people in the camp we were taking to see apartments, we were actively working with most of the people that were moved from the Calliope corridor. And so it's just really disappointing to see our work undermined in this way.
So to be clear, and you can correct me, Martha, if I'm saying anything wrong, for people that are saying the state was enforcing the law that the city didn't, and my takeaway from this is when you said now you're going to get calls today from people in the neighborhoods where they were pushed, where the homeless people were pushed, all this did was push people two blocks down the street so they wouldn't be seen out of sight, out of mind for the Taylor Swift crowd. Is that in any way inaccurate, what I said?
No, that is exactly true. And the sad thing is, I think Taylor Swift will be very upset.
She would be the last one that would want that, from what I understand.
Yeah, she's a humanitarian. She cares about poor people. I mean, she would not want this done in her name.
And as she
believes, we may actually get very negative publicity. You know, we're seeing, Louisianians are seen as caring people. And I think this looked like we don't care about some of the most vulnerable people in our population, when in fact we care very much, and the public has been supporting this work. And I would just encourage people to, you know, contribute to our warehouse, you know, go to your cupboard, give us dishes that you don't need, pots and pans, towels, bedding. We need all that because we're housing a massive number of people. In the last year alone, we've housed 1,155 people.
Martha, real quick, we're out of time. If somebody wants to help, how do they do it? Where do they go?
They can contact us at homelesswarehouse@unitygno.org or call 483-9300, 483-9300.
Thank you. Got to go. 7:31, time for WWL First News. 7:46 now, 14 till 8. Tommy Tucker, WWL. I see a tweet here from Bob Marshall about the Mid-Barrett area sediment diversion related to a story where the feds are saying, you know, you either got to get going on this Mid-Barrett area sediment diversion or somebody owes us $500 million and we want our money back. And he said, Bob Marshall says, wow, time for Governor Landry to choose between Oyster Buddies or the rest of coastal residents and businesses. With that, we welcome in our guest, Alicia Renfro, a senior manager of science and policy for the National Wildlife Federation's golf program. Alicia, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good.
I know you probably don't want to weigh into the politics of all of this, but tell me what the scientists are saying as it relates to the leading scientists, as it relates to Louisiana's coastal master plan, a portion of which is the Mid-Barrett area sediment diversion. Accurate?
Yeah, so, you know, there was recently a letter where 40 scientists signed on in support of the Coastal Master Plan and using science to guide restoration in Louisiana. We, as scientists, think it's really important that we take the opportunity that we have with the funding that is available to actually use the science to build restoration projects that work together that benefit Louisiana over the long term. We can do a lot of restoration that's just kind of random acts of restoration and not have a lot to show for it 20, 30 years down the line. But the Coastal Master Plan provides an opportunity to come up with a suite of projects that can work together to benefit Louisiana in the long run.
So I live right down the street from somebody who I think is the president of the Oyster Harvesters. I forgot the name of the organization. His son, and look, I care about the people in Plaquemines Parish. I care about the oyster fishermen. I also care about the state in general. And what does the science say about the master plan, about the portions, these 40 scientists, I guess, what exactly have they signed on to, Doctor? That's what I'm asking you.
Yeah, so, I mean, it is in support of the master plan process itself. And we all know that our coast has changed a lot over the last few years. Anybody who's been out in our coastal marshes on a consistent basis, scientists, oystermen, shrimpers, we see that change happening. And so what this is about is, like, how do we actually build a better future for Louisiana and try to actually still have all those things, have oysters, have shrimp, have all the fish that we want to pursue, but actually use the river that built all of South Louisiana, once again, mimic the natural processes to build and restore land. And I don't think we have to choose between those things. There's room for all of that, but it's going to change maybe where things are. We're going to maybe have to develop technologies to make it so that fishermen can be more flexible, whether that's, you know, on-boat refrigeration or helping upgrade boats. It can all happen, but we have to actually work together to make it happen.
One question I've had that I ask every time I talk to anybody about this, and Doctor, I might have asked you this question before, but when we talk about oyster fishermen and the livelihood and dolphins and everything else, I don't know if it can be said this simply or not, but it seems as though if I'm going 10 miles down the road to harvest oysters, and before I had to go 50 miles down, or after the diversion, I'll have to go 50 miles down the road. Was I going 50 miles down the road? And this is just a gross generalization, obviously, but am I just going back to 50 miles down the road, which is where I had to go before the land loss, which is the diversion is designed to reestablish. So it's not as though really this is a great hardship. It's just, it was made a lot more convenient for me, and we're just putting it back to like it was. Tell you what, I got to stop for traffic. You can answer when we come back, if you would, please, because I'm trying to get a handle on this. I really am. 7:50, 10 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:55, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Dr. Alicia Renfro, Senior Manager of Science and Policy for the National Wildlife Federation's Gulf Program. Group of 40 leading scientists released a letter supporting Louisiana's coastal master plan, part of which is the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion. A story in the NOLA.com today saying that, you know, the federal government saying either fish or cut bait, because if you don't get going with this project, somebody owes us $500 million that have already been spent on this. I was asking you before the break, Doctor, and again, I'm maybe somebody that texted in phrased it a little better than I did it. They say, sounds like man-made levees interrupted natural process, and this diversion is just trying to reestablish natural process. And my question was, okay, so if now oyster fishermen have to travel, and this is, again, a simplification, but 10 miles to get oysters, and after this is done, they're going to have to go 50 miles. Well, did they have to go 50 miles before the erosion happened, and they're just going back to where they had to go initially?
Yeah, in many cases, that's completely true. The system has changed over time, and people have started, growing oysters far more inland than they did in the past.
So it's kind of like I gave you, and this is, again, going to be maybe a bad analogy, but you started leaving. You were supposed to work till 5 o'clock. Then you started leaving at 4. Then you started leaving at 3. Now you're leaving at noon. Guess what? We're going to make it where you got to work till 5 o'clock again, which was the original thing, and now everybody's complaining? Am I on to anything here or not?
Yeah, I think it's similar to that. I think people are really good at changing slowly with time, and that is what has continued to happen. And now this is the mid-Barataria diversion will change salinities and will cause another change that may be a little bit more abrupt than what had happened in the past, but it's just moving those lines farther out towards the Gulf of Mexico. And people are really good at change, but also really hate change and will often fight it every step of the way.
So you're a scientist. You know nothing happens in a vacuum, right? How do you mm-hmm. separate the politics from this? And if so many people are for this, who could be against it and why?
You know, I think that is the real power of the Coastal Master Plan, is trying to take the politics out of restoration, to actually look at what the science tells us about where we can locate projects, what kind of projects can work together overall to, you know, build a better future. There are a lot of people that are supportive of this. There are people that have concerns, and I think it is good to listen to those concerns. I think with something like the Mid-Barataria diversion, the concerns are built into the project to address impacts that may happen, adjustments that need to be made in terms of mitigation, stewardship for commercial fisheries, for things like dolphins. But there's that fear of change happening. People have gotten used to the unnatural system that we currently have. And so restoring those natural processes can seem scary.
So what happens if you got the financial considerations, federal government wants their $500 million back if this doesn't proceed. But, and again, that's probably a very gross oversimplification of what's going on here legally. But scientifically, what happens if the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion does not proceed?
We will have the Barataria Basin will continue to suffer from having a lack of consistent sediment input. We'll continue to lose land. That basin in particular, looking into the future, loses a lot of land. Even if we do things like marsh creation projects and ridge restoration, you're going to lose a whole lot of land in the Barataria Basin without Mid-Barataria.
Thank you. I appreciate the time. Dr. Alicia Renfro, Senior Manager of Science and Policy for the National Wildlife Federation's Gulf Program. Somebody texted in and said, I'm torn. I grew up running the bayous and lakes south of Lafitte. Shrimping and crabbing is in my blood, but I know for a fact that the Barataria Basin looks nothing like it did 30 years ago. I'd have destroyed my old camp on Bayou Norman. What protections we had ain't there no more. This diversion has to happen, or we may not have a population to buy the oysters, crabs, or shrimp. We'll take a break. We come back. We're going to talk to Dr. B, Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health. Talk about the importance of primary care providers when we come back on WWL. Thursday morning, 8:14, Dr. B joins us, Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health, to talk about the importance of visiting your primary care provider. How you doing, Dr. B? Good morning.
Hey, Tommy. I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm okay, sir. So if you haven't visited your primary care provider this year, you really ought to schedule an appointment. Dr. B from People's Health is going to discuss primary care and share five tips for making the most of your next visit. I guess before we talk about tips, we should talk about what is a primary care provider.
Yeah, absolutely. So a primary care provider, we call ourselves PCPs, because I am one. We really are kind of your best friend for good health. And what we do is we practice general health care. You can see us for a lot of different things, but in particular, we focus a lot on preventative care. And that may include things like vaccinations or healthy living recommendations. But then we also treat a whole host of illnesses, you know, things that are simple like sinus infections or the flu or, you know, other types of infections. But we also help you manage all of your chronic health conditions, things like diabetes, high blood pressure, and heart disease.
And primary care physicians or providers are not only for elderly people, right?
No, not at all. In fact, everybody should have a primary care provider.
Why is it so important to have a primary care provider?
Yeah, so, you know, through these regular visits that you have with your PCP, they really get to know you, and they get to know what's going on with your health and what your history is. That really lets them monitor any changes that happen in your health over time. And that way we can kind of develop a more specific and personalized plan of care for you. And we really, like I said, we help manage your overall care, but on occasion, we're going to have to send you out to somebody else for specialized care, and we can actually help to coordinate that as well. We're going to help you stay up to date with all of your immunizations and health screenings as well. So it's really a whole host of things that we tackle.
How often are you supposed to visit your PCP?
Yeah, this is something a lot of people forget, but everyone who's 30 years or older really needs to have a PCP visit at least once a year for your annual checkup. And then for those people that have chronic conditions, things like diabetes or high blood pressure, you might actually need additional appointments throughout the year to see your PCP.
Why is that?
Well, really, you know, if you've got one of those long-lasting health conditions, you really do need that personalized and kind of holistic plan of care. And, you know, it's going to include a whole host of things. Definitely, you know, medical services and maybe prescription drugs. But in particular, things like healthy living recommendations to really, you know, make your life better and control any disease you may have better. And we're going to help you develop that treatment plan and then guide you through it. So, you know, when you do follow up with your PCP, we're going to check how well you're doing with your treatment. Are you taking your medications? Do you have any new symptoms? Do you have any side effects from those medications as well? And then we can make adjustments to that plan throughout the year to make you feel better and be better.
All right, let's get to some tips about making the most of your primary care appointments. Tip number one.
Yeah, so this is really important. So I always tell people to prepare in advance for your appointment. And, you know, don't just walk in the door and not know what you're going to talk about. So when you schedule that appointment, you know, first and foremost, make sure that your doctor takes your insurance. You don't want to get stuck with a big healthcare bill. And then, you know, request any accommodations you might need. So, you know, if you're in a wheelchair, make sure you know how to access the building. If you need a translator, make sure that that is set up as well. And if you want to bring a family member with you, make sure that you've arranged that with them. And then on the day of the appointment, make sure you bring everything you need. So bring your insurance card, a valid ID, and then a list of all your medications. And this is really important. You know, that list needs to include any over-the-counter items you're taking, things like vitamins or supplements or even over-the-counter medications. And I tell people, really bring all your medication bottles in with you for that first appointment so we can take a look at them and actually read directly what's on the labels.
So why is it so important that you bring them in with you?
Yeah, it's critical. People don't always remember what they're taking, especially some of those over-the-counter medicines that they may be taking. And sometimes they can interact with each other and they can cause a lot of dangerous side effects. And so your PCP can really review everything you're taking and find any potential problems and make adjustments as needed. And then knowing that full medication routine makes it easier for us to adjust the medications or address any sort of side effects that you may be having.
Anything else you should bring to your appointment with your PCP?
Yeah, you know, it's important to bring a notepad with you. And on that notepad, you want to list the questions that you're going to ask your PCP, because visits can be very quick and rapid, and you don't want to forget something that's really important or spend time, you know, trying to remember what you wanted to ask your doctor about. So, you know, jot down your three or four top priority questions, so in case you don't have time to discuss everything, you're hitting those high points. And if you're visiting a brand new provider, you also want to jot down some things about your own personal medical history, but also any family history that you have, because that's going to be really important. A lot of diseases run in families. We may want to screen you for some of those if we know that you've got a mom, dad, brother, or sister that has a certain health condition.
All right, 8:20 now on this Thursday morning, talking to Dr. B, Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health, about the importance of seeing your primary care provider and five tips to make the most of your visit. We've already gone through tip number one. We'll pick it up with number two when we come back. Right now, traffic, WWL. 26, Tommy Tucker, WWO, back with Dr. B. Not to be disagreeable or anything, but I think the jolly bearded fellow will be in Lafayette today, and that's Dr. B, Dr. Brent Wallace. He'll be with Newell Norman today. You heard the promo there. Let's talk about primary care providers and some tips to make the most out of your visit. What's your second tip, Dr. B?
Yeah, so you want to try to arrive early to your appointment if possible. And the main reason for that is you really want to maximize your time that you have with your PCP. Make sure that the visit isn't rushed and you're addressing all of those questions that you have. And, you know, build in time for unexpected delays or you know, things like traffic, or if you've got to park and walk over to the clinic as well. And then some offices have online check-in where you can actually fill out your paperwork in advance. That'll save you a little bit of time and keep you from waiting in the waiting room for too long.
What about tip number three?
Yeah, so this is really important. You want to make sure you answer your doctor's questions honestly. And, you know, when you're asked about lifestyle, you might be tempted to say what you think we want to hear. Mm-hmm. But really, you get the best care when your PCP knows the full picture of your health and all of your habits. So, you know, for example, if you smoke or you drink alcohol, you want to tell your doctor about that and be honest about the amount that you do that. Also, if you have trouble taking any of your medications consistently, or maybe you're not taking your medications because of a side effect, you want to tell us about that as well.
And I would think you probably might want to do a little audit of your activities before you go, so you realize maybe just exactly how much you do drink.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes that visit's an opportunity to really reflect a little bit. And, you know, so that's why it's so important to be honest, because we'll tell you what we think about it.
I have a drink a day. Well, wait, maybe more like two. Well, actually, you know, come to think of it, I get hammered every night. I'm just saying that this kind of thing you need to be honest with your doctor about. How about tip number four?
Yeah, so don't be afraid to ask us questions. You know, I have a lot of visits where people don't say very much, but it's really important to ask any questions that you have. You know, we cover a lot of information, usually pretty quickly. Sometimes you can get confused, and your PCP should not mind explaining or repeating something, but you've got to ask us about that. That's really critical.
And how about your final tip?
Yeah, so that notepad that you brought, you can also take notes on it. And it's important because a lot of things do happen in the visit. You want to make sure you walk out of there knowing what was discussed. So if any new medications are started, you can write down the instructions. We're usually going to give you healthy living recommendations, so you can write that down. And then also follow-up appointments, dates of future appointments, or if we've had to refer you to a specialist. And one thing to keep in mind now, most clinics should be giving you a printout of everything that happened in the visit as well, so that's going to help a little bit.
Any final thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, really, primary care is essential to staying healthy. It's really important to aging well. So even if you've got a really busy schedule like so many people do, try to make time for a PCP visit. You've got 9 weeks left in the year. It's a huge investment in your health. So it's really, really important.
So tell me about today. Where are y'all going to be in Lafayette?
Yeah, so we're going to be at 318 Gilbo Road for the grand opening of Primary Care Plus in Lafayette. Well, I'm really excited about it. I saw Newell last night. I know I'm going to see him this morning.
At the pre-party, right? The sponsors party? Yeah. I'm just kidding.
The pre-party, yeah.
All right. Thank you, Dr. B. Appreciate it as always. Y'all can find out more about People's Health at the People's Health Medicare Center in Metairie. Open enrollment underway. It's located at 3017 Vets next to Party City. Appointments are recommended. Walk-ins are welcome. You can always go to peopleshealth.com or call People's Health at 1-800-978-9765. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Jeff Nowak about the Saints-Chargers game coming up and the injury report. Right now, time for WWL First News. Here we go, 8:46, 14 till 9. Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter, joins us. Talk about the injury report, Chargers game, etc. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing good. Looking forward to heading out to L.A. this weekend. It's been a while. We set up residence out there, and I haven't been back, so I need
That's
to kind
true,
of
check huh?
out.
That's true, huh? I didn't realize that it was a return trip after training camp. Boy, it seems like the game against the Broncos a long time ago, which is good in a way. Tell me about the Saints injury situation.
Yeah, so it seems like they're going in the right direction, which is a nice thing to say. You know, obviously these players are not getting back this week, and you kind of know that. Derek Carr didn't practice on Wednesday. That's not a surprise. Eric McCoy still on injured reserve. Will Harris is still on injured reserve. But you did get several key players back. Pete Warner was back to practice for the first time in a while. He's missed multiple games. Taysom Hill was back to practice for the first time in a while. He's missed multiple games. Cesar Ruiz is back to practice for the first time in a while. You get the idea. He's missed multiple games. So, you know, one of the better bits of news, too, is Marshawn Lattimore's listed on here. So is Spencer Rattler, but both were full participants. So, you know, ideally, you know, a lot of these guys were limited. Ideally, they'll be full participants today, tomorrow. But, you know, it's trending in the direction of, hey, you're still going to be without your starting quarterback. You're still going to be without a few key players, but you should at least have a good number of starters back. And so that shouldn't be, you know, the reason you can't win, let's put it that way, when you go out to SoFi this weekend.
I heard somebody refer to Taysom Hill as the X factor, which got me to thinking that he should wear an X on his jersey instead of a number. Be the Roman numeral,
yeah,
10.
I think the analogy I used was kind of like, he's kind of like a really sharp set of dentures that you could, the offense puts in its mouth and you start eating red meat again. You know, otherwise you're kind of just like a turtle trying to eat a sirloin. You just don't get the, you can't really tear into it the way you want to, right?
You don't put in a blender or anything.
Exactly. You got to eat smoothies, and you know, now you can kind of start to gash defenses again. So hopefully that's the case. Hopefully he's a full go. You know, he's been out for a while. He hasn't played since week four against the Falcons. So, you know, that would be nice, because I just think, you know, you'd like to see Spencer Rattler, and they're sticking with Spencer Rattler. That's what DA said on Monday, which is I think is the right way to do it. If you're going to stick with a young guy, you want to kind of build him up, you know, and still confidence in him, not have him sitting there kind of waiting for the rug to get pulled out. But, you know, he's got to be better, right? And I think you kind of look at it like, okay, he had two games in the span of 5 days. That's tough for any quarterback. It's a lot more difficult for a rookie quarterback who didn't even really get any time to kind of assess his first start before his second start. So, you know, I'd like to think that with 10 days to kind of reevaluate and come up with a plan, you could see a more representative showing. And also just like, hey, I guess one guy I didn't mention was Chris Olave. He was also back to practice dealing with a concussion. You know, you get some of these weapons back, right? Like, it's bad enough you're having to go turn to a rookie in this situation and ask him to go win you some games. It's even worse that you're putting him in a situation that he is not set up for success in. He doesn't have either starting wide receiver. He's dealing with a patchwork offensive line. Alvin Kamara, you know, we'll talk more about him, I'm sure. You know, he's dealing with a broken hand, a broken rib, hip pointer, like all these different issues. So he's not 100%. So it would be nice to see Spencer get out there in a situation where he at least has the pieces around him to succeed, because I don't think he's had that to this point.
41 is tough as tough can be. I don't know what else you could ask out of him. I'm glad to see that he got his deal. We'll talk about that in a second. One thing, you talk about patchwork offensive line. You know, Jeff, I follow this, and I had to look up number 60 to see who Kyle Hergel was during the Denver Broncos game. I really did, and I follow this. So, you know, I mean, man, I'm looking at the report here. You got Lucas Patrick and Connor McGovern, both limited practice. One of them's got to go. If not, I don't know who's going to be playing center. You?
Yeah, I would anticipate both of those guys play, right? Connor's been close. Connor has played. Lucas has been close each of the last 2 weeks. He was questionable going into the Bucs game. He didn't play. He was active for the Broncos game. I think he was kind of available as that emergency offensive lineman. But, like, just the fact that you were willing to put him in the game if you needed to is kind of indicative that with 10 days he should be ready to go this week. I think it's important. I would expect Connor to still be your center. That's going to be an interesting decision they have to make. I think you'll probably stick with Lucas at left guard and go with Connor at center. I think they like how he has played. It's tough. And, you know, I think these guys missing, it doesn't only impact that position. It impacts the guys next to them, right? Like, yep. I think Trevor Penning and Talia Sifuaga have played well, but, you know, they're going to be better when they have those veterans next to them and not kind of this revolving door of backups.
And
cohesiveness. Right? I think Trevor Penning played a lot better when Cesar Ruiz was there, and you get the idea, yeah.
The offensive line, cohesiveness of the unit, man, is like a dance team. I hate to say that, but it is, really. And we had an interesting conversation with Deuce. Y'all can go back and go to WWL.com and click on my name and listen to the conversation. But he was talking about the importance of the continuity in the offensive line and so forth. And McGovern wasn't even on the team until, 4 weeks ago? Right?
Yeah, I mean, he was debating retirement. You know, he was pretty close. He was on the Jets practice squad. He was getting ready to go out to London. I think he was a couple hours from getting on the bus. And then the Saints called, and he was like, all right, I guess I'll change my flight. He caught a flight out of Newark, and he's here. Funny thing about Connor is he was debating retirement, right, before he signed on the Jets practice squad. And if he retired, he would go up to, I want to say, South Dakota and work on his family's potato farm. Mm. So he was very close to becoming a potato farmer. Instead, he put in, you know, he put the weight back on. He came out here to play for the Saints. So, yeah, he's got a fallback.
Another great story in addition to, I got to say it, Daratla. We'll take a break. More with Jeff Nowak when we come back. 8:52, 8 till 9. Traffic now, WWO. 8:56, Tommy Tucker, WWO, back with Jeff Nowak, Saints sideline reporter. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. Alvin Kamara's deal is done, Jeff. But even with that being said, I don't know how the man could give you any more than he's already been giving you. Thoughts?
Yeah, you know, that's the thing. You know, you look at a lot of players and you might say, hey, you know, he's probably been, you know, withholding something, you know, not giving you his all because he's kind of worried about that contract. I just don't think that's how it works for Alvin. I think he was kind of committed to doing this, you know, the right way, but for his teammates. And I think the team saw that, they rewarded that, right? And that's the right thing to do. You want players to kind of go about it this way. That's how you would like your offseason to go. You don't want to have to deal with 2 to 3 players holding out for contracts every season. At least the Saints can now kind of, you know, look at players and say, hey, we'll do right by you. You just got to continue to do the work.
This is saying a lot.
So that's a good sign.
And I've been around a while, this is saying a lot, but in terms of toughness, loyalty, dependability, other than the mishap in Las Vegas, I got to make Alvin Kamara one of my favorite Saints of all time. I'm not kidding, if not the best. Let's talk about the Chargers and how they shape up. And well, let me take a step back. Jeff, first of all, it has seemed like a long time since the Denver game. You think the Saints have kind of regrouped, and I know they got a couple of days off, right? Get everything together, get their heads together, come back, start all over?
They better have.
Yeah.
You know, they got to work better than they did against the Broncos, because the fact is, like, that's not the team that we've seen all offseason, that we were in the last 2 weeks against the Bucs and the Chargers and the Broncos. It's not the team we've seen the first 5 weeks of the season even. So I like to think that that's kind of an aberration, and you just kind of hit the end of the line with some of these injuries and some of the energy levels that you could have pulled out of guys. And that extra time off hopefully helps some guys reset, because, you know, the biggest issue the Saints have had, stopping the run. What do the Chargers do? They run the ball. Like, they are committed to running the ball. They're going to bang their head against the wall and hope and see how long it takes to break. And, you know, hopefully the Saints can figure something out there, because you can't be a good defense if you can't stop the run. That's just the fact at the end of the day. No good defense in NFL history has been gashed on the ground the way the Saints have. So that's going to be the key. And it's kind of a broken record. You say that every week. But until they can do it, I'm going to keep saying it, you've got to find a way to stop the run.
And Jim Harbaugh is no different than any other NFL coach. They find a weakness, so what do? They step on it, right? They put the heel on it pretty much and grind?
Oh, yeah. That's what good coaches do. They identify a weakness and they attack it. And the weakness of the Saints right now is the run game, and the Chargers have a really good running back in J.K. Dobbins, who they're gonna just hammer. You know, he's got almost 500 rushing yards already, 75 yards to carry. So you're going to see a lot of them. It's going to be a matter of how you handle them.
Pete Werner expected to play?
I think he is. We'll have to see the next couple of days, but I would expect him back, yeah.
All right, thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it as always. Have a good trip out to L.A. Say hello to all your friends you made out there.
Sounds good, Tommy. Thanks.
All right, you bet. 8:59, we'll take a break. We come back, we're going to talk to Walter Dublin, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at UNO. We're going to spend some time discussing Kamala Harris's plan and Donald Trump's plan when it comes to health care, and about how the U.S. healthcare system currently works, and what's left over from Obamacare and what's not. And speaking of healthcare, the Pelicans are going to need some. Zion missed last night. Hopefully he'll be back. DeJounte Murray breaks his non-shooting hand. So we'll talk to Ali Cosell about that. Big hour coming up. Stay with us. 9:09 as we make our way through this Thursday morning. We thought we'd take some time with the early voting underway in the presidential election looming to compare and contrast the health care plans of both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. So we invited our friend Walter Dublin, our go-to guy when it comes to health care. He's an associate professor of economics and finance at my alma mater, UNO, to help kind of walk us through it. How you doing, Dub?
Hey, good morning, Tommy. Good to be here.
I don't even know how you start to compare these two. I don't know if you look at different, if you look at different aspects of the healthcare program, and then what each is suggesting. What do you think would be the best way to go about this?
Well, I will tell you, it is difficult because neither one of them has a well spelled out plan. They've kind of made some suggestions about different approaches that they might have. So you can kind of talk about that, but that's kind of about all we can do.
Let me do this. Let me take a step back maybe for context and talk about where are we. Take us back to Obamacare, Affordable Health Care Act. What's changed since then? What hasn't? And if somebody doesn't have insurance right now through their company, what are their options?
Okay, well, Obamacare did a number of things, but the biggest one was it basically made sure that it made available insurance available to a large number of people. Of the 50 million that were uninsured in 2014 when this went into effect, you know, more than half of them got insurance through Obamacare two ways. One is the Medicaid rollout, which, again, Louisiana did under Edwin Edwards. John Bell Edwards, excuse me. and then the other one is they have these individual plans, which are heavily subsidized. And that one got, in the pandemic, that got kicked up a lot more so that you can really buy very affordable, some type of very affordable insurance. So that gave access to a lot more people having insurance. Did several other things. One of the other big ones is that insurance used to almost all be regulated by the state. That was federalized by Obamacare, by the Affordable Care Act, so that now they set the rules of anybody that wants to offer insurance as to what you have to offer. Includes all of these type of programs. So, those are the big things that that the ACA did.
So if somebody now, how has it changed since that went into effect? Have they changed it a lot or not?
Well, the only major change since then has been for Louisiana, because Louisiana didn't immediately, like, well, there's 12 other southern states that have not done the Medicaid rollout. And what that did was change the eligibility. Before John Bell Edwards accepted the new plan, which was paid for 90% by the federal government, to get on Medicaid in the United States, in Louisiana, was almost impossible. Basically, it was only available to women with children or pregnant, that a kind of a single person almost never could qualify, and they had to be very poor. But then all of a sudden the eligibility changed to anybody up to 138% of the federal poverty line, which for family of four is like now 35,000 or so. So all of a sudden all those people got onto Medicaid. The only thing that's changed is that the single policies that you buy through healthcare.gov during the pandemic, they basically opened that up. Well, they opened the pandemic. They opened Medicaid up to almost anybody. Mm-hmm. And then they also opened up those policies to make them much more generous in terms of the subsidies that people got. Because usually to be on Medicaid, you have to check your actual income, right, to qualify. Well, they stopped doing that during the pandemic. And last year or so, they started doing that again, and a number of 100,000 people got kicked off that weren't eligible. This coming year, all of these big subsidies that went in the pandemic are due to expire. So the pandemic is the only other thing that's been a major change since 2014.
Okay, so there's still no upper limits. They still can't deny you for pre-existing conditions, and you can still keep
right. Those are some other things that went in. The pre-existing condition exclusions were outlawed, and the upper limits were outlawed. That was part of the Affordable Care Act as well.
And that's still that way, right?
Correct. That's not going away.
And what about keeping your kid on your policy until they're 26?
Right. yeah, that's, again, like I say, there were a lot of other, I mentioned kind of the biggest ones, but the pre-existing condition one was a huge one, because a lot of people who had pre-existing conditions basically couldn't buy insurance, and all of a sudden Obamacare opened that door to all of those people, and they rushed in and bought that with, of course, at very highly subsidized rates. That's been one of the huge ones.
So somebody texted in and wants to know about pre-existing conditions and buying insurance. If they don't have insurance and they know they need some type of operation, why would an insurance company take their premium to pay for the operation when after that they could drop the insurance? It just seems like one thing I never did understand about this, Dub, was from the insurance company standpoint, it's like, wait a minute, you're going to sign up for insurance, you're going to get your liver operated on or whatever you need, then you're going to drop it, so I'm on the hook for paying for your insurance. How do the insurance companies make this a sustainable business model for them?
Well, it really hasn't been very sustainable. This is a big problem. Now, originally, the way they were supposed to handle that was they had what's called the individual mandate, but that never worked. Mm-hmm. The idea was, well, the way we'll do it is we'll make sure people can't drop out because they have to have insurance. Well, the penalties they put on it were so small that when Trump did away with that provision, nobody noticed. So that one never worked.
Wait, it is a major problem.
The individual mandate.
The way you had to buy insurance.
That said that if you don't buy insurance, then you're going to have to pay a big tax penalty.
Right.
Well, the tax penalty was very small, and then it really never happened. Nobody really paid attention to it, and then Trump did away with that part of it. There is a corporate mandate that anybody with 50 employees or more must offer an affordable plan to all of their employees. And so that one has been enforced and has had a big effect.
So from the insurance company's standpoint, I'm still trying to figure this out. If I don't have insurance and I get diagnosed with some kind of liver, something or the other, pick an organ, I don't care, whatever it is, and I need to have it operated on and I don't have insurance through my company, I go to the healthcare.gov, I try to buy insurance, I can't be denied for a pre-existing condition, and I tell whomever it is that's providing this insurance, I want to sign up for a policy. Can they ask me why? Or you understand what I'm saying, Dad?
It's hard to believe, but that's the way the law was written.
So,
and we've had some cases of people actually signing up while in the hospital bed, that type of thing. But
do the insurance companies, how do they make that work from the profit standpoint? Do they just make the premiums so high? Is there any limit on what they can charge for the premiums?
Well, I mean, that is the other part of it is that the federal government's paying most of the premiums. So a lot of people are still getting it because for many people, the premiums are actually really pretty small if you're a fairly middle income person or less. I think a lot of people just signed up for it just to cover, more normal type of stuff. But you're right, there's a huge loophole out there in terms of people can sign up whenever they want to.
Wow. So are there procedures that somebody else texted in? Are there procedures that the insurance companies can deny, or do the insurance companies and the healthcare.gov have to cover all procedures?
No, they can do. There's a prior authorization, it's called, that if the insurance company determines that the procedure is kind of new or experimental, something like that, or if they don't think it's necessary, that the patient doesn't have they're worried that the doctor's doing unnecessary procedures, they can deny to pay for certain procedures. Yes, and they do.
So hypothetically speaking, somebody's unemployed, they need surgery, they go to healthcare.gov. They sign up, they get a policy. The government's going to pay for most of that. Just bear with me here and tell me if I'm saying anything wrong. Then they get their surgery, and then they can choose not to have insurance after that?
They can, but of course, if they're really that unemployed, they wouldn't get on the healthcare.gov, they would get on Medicaid, because healthcare.gov does have, even though it has some premiums, it also has deductibles. If you're in the bronze plan, you might have $4,000 to $6,000 that you would have to pay before the insurance kicks in. But Medicaid has no premiums, and it has no copays and no deductibles. So that's the one that people want to get on if they qualify.
And what about procedures that Medicaid approves?
Well, again, now Medicaid is much more generous about approving things. It's that because healthcare.gov is private insurance. You're getting a Blue Cross or a United plan, and those people have a policy of denying it. Medicare and Medicaid really don't do that nearly as much.
But Medicaid's a state program. Medicare is a federal program, right?
Correct. I mean, well, there, yes, the Medicaid is a state program. Yeah, I mean, it's funded mostly by the federal government, but the state does have to kick in for the old people that were on Medicaid before the expansion. The state pays about a third of the cost in Louisiana, or 40%, and the federal government pays the rest. But people that signed up later under the new plan, which is like half of the Medicaid recipients, the federal government pays for 90%, and the state only pays 10%.
The state does run
the Medicaid program.
So somebody texted in about cancer treatment, and if they're on Medicaid, they would have to stay within the state?
Well, I think, again, the Medicaid is a state program. And so normally you would, I don't know for sure about this. So I think you might get exceptions if you had something you wanted to go over to MD Anderson or whatever.
Of course,
we now could go to MD Anderson in the state at Ochsner or St. Tammany or a place like that. But still,
is how much choice do you have if you're on Medicaid of where you go to get your treatment?
You pretty much could go any place. I don't know. In terms of going out of the state, I'd have to double check on that. But you basically will go to anybody that will accept you. Which, again, almost all community hospitals will accept the Medicaid patients. There's some of these, private doctor-owned surgery centers that don't accept Medicare or Medicaid patients. But they can go if they have a surgery that's needed. Now, sometimes they have a problem getting a surgeon because the doctors, a lot of them do not. Most of them don't accept Medicaid patients, or at least very few. So sometimes they have a problem with that. But I think all hospitals do accept them.
So you get in the hospital, just can't find anybody to operate on you.
Well, I mean, if you come in through the emergency room, then there'll be a doctor pretty much assigned to you, and you'll end up getting it done. But
if it's an emergency but not an elective procedure.
Right.
Yeah. It's complicated, man, I'm telling you. And let's take a break. We come back.
It's very, very complicated.
It is. That's why we lean on you heavily, Dublin, over at UNO.
Okay.
When we come back, somebody wants to know about the Medicaid expansion, how that's affected hospitals and doctors in Louisiana. We'll also talk about reproductive rights. We'll talk about prescription drug care and everything else. And then how much really control does whatever president have over any of this, or is it all about the Congress? It's complicated, and I hate personally dealing with anything as it relates to any type of insurance at all, as do, I'm sure, most of the people that are listening right now. Thankfully, Dublin studies it for a living. He's over at UNO, our go-to guy when it comes to matters about healthcare, associate professor of economics and finance at UNO. You have any questions, comments, 504-260-1870. Tommy Tucker, back in a flash on WWL. Talking to Dub Lane, our professor of economics and finance at UNO, my alma mater, about healthcare costs and affordable healthcare and the differences between what Trump and Harris are proposing. Before we get to any of that and Medicaid and everything else, so much of this has to do with the Congress, correct? Because I'm thinking of John McCain and his thumbs down vote.
Well, yes, that is the president. You know, we're looking at the presidential policies, but anything, they have some control, but not much. Most anything would have to come through the Congress. And so the Senate, what's happening in the Senate and the House is extremely important to whatever directions we end up making. So, if Trump went, of course, now Trump for 8 years said they wanted to repeal and replace Affordable Care Act. He's not even saying that anymore, but he wants to do a certain other things. He wants to move it more in kind of a market direction, what's called consumer-directed health plans, which are kind of high-deductible health plans, together with health savings accounts. It seems to be an emphasis of his. Harris is really looking more towards expanding Obamacare to more people and, you know, controlling drug costs, things of that sort.
So how has the Medicaid expansion affected hospitals and doctors in Louisiana?
Well, it's been a trade-off, because before the Medicaid expansion, for instance, I'm also on the board of a local hospital. You know, we had about 8% of all of our patients were uninsured. Well, you know, uninsured patients cover about 10% of their costs, because some uninsured patients are actually fairly wealthy people that just don't have insurance, but most of them don't pay anything. And so all of a sudden, a big hunk of those got on Medicaid. And so our total uninsured went down to less than 2%. But then it replaced them with a bunch of Medicaid patients. The Medicaid patients only cover about 65% of the cost of actually caring for them. So they're heavily subsidized. And then the other trade-off was to pay for the Affordable Care Act. What they did was cut payments to hospitals from Medicare. So now they're getting less money on Medicare. So the whole... the whole package has been kind of a trade-off for hospitals.
So everybody wants to do something about prescription drug prices. How likely is that to happen, and how do you even go about that? Because it seems as though in maybe this drug or that drug, they have made a difference, but in a lot of others, they don't.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's this $35 for insulin thing that's both parties are, promoting. But then the other one is, you know, Biden has identified a dozen of these really high-cost drugs that they're trying to negotiate prices on, and they're wanting to add more every year. Harris has said she wants to continue that and expand that program. There's a lot of fight over that. Obviously, the pharmaceutical companies and a lot of other people don't like that. But I will tell you something that's really, you know, I don't think the average person knows, is that pharmaceuticals are far and away the fastest growing component of our healthcare system. 10, 15 years ago, they were only about 12% of all the costs that the insurance companies paid. Now they're over 22%. So there's been a huge increase in pharmaceutical costs in the last decade or so. So
is that, because
is a concern.
The price of the pharmaceuticals, is it because of advertising and people wanting these medications? Is it because of the type of medication? And where, Dub, while I'm asking this big long question, where do pharmacy benefit managers fit in all of this? Because that's something that doesn't get a lot of attention, but it's an integral cog in this, right?
It is. And that, you talk about the confusing, that's the most confusing part. It has to do with some of these are these new drugs that Ozempic and all these other things like that they've come up with that have big ticket items. Some of them are really good. For some of the new cancer drugs are pretty effective, but you've got some that are costing $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year. That's really a big deal. So a lot of these other are very expensive, but some of the drug companies have really done some things like the little EpiPen. Well, those have been around forever, and somehow or another, the price of those went from $50 to $600. So they've been taking things that have been existed and just jacking up the price. And partly it's because the insurance companies, really, that's one area where they don't really have much ability to control what they do. For the doctors and hospitals, they kind of negotiate on prices. But for drugs, they're almost required to cover certain drugs. And so it gets dumped on them. They can't even negotiate with the drug companies because they have to go through the pharmacy benefit managers. So these PBMs, they're called pharmacy benefit managers, are wholesalers that deal with all the actual, FISA and all these other big drug companies, and there's like 100 of them. You know, there's about 6 or 7 really big ones, but there's a whole bunch of little ones. And they buy the drugs at wholesale, and then they sell them to the drug stores.
All right, let me slow you down a little bit if I can.
Yes.
So let's talk about a pharmacy benefit manager. The day in the life of a pharmacy benefit manager, you said they have 6 big ones, 100 all overall about. What does a pharmacy benefit manager do?
Well, I say, there's about 6 big pharmacy producers.
Okay.
But the pharmacy benefit managers are the wholesalers.
Okay.
So they buy the drugs from the producers.
A middleman?
And
like?
Then, what's that?
Like a middleman?
They are middlemen, exactly. Okay. And they're wholesalers. And then, for instance, your local Walgreens or other pharmacy or the hospitals, when they want to buy, you know, drugs for cancer, their cancer treatment or whatever it is, they buy their drugs through the PBMs. Blue Cross, I've got the chief economist of Blue Cross is a friend of mine, and he's got amazing information on this. But, you know, they basically they can't do anything. The pharmacy benefit managers pretty much tell them, here's the prices, and they're stuck with it. They have really no negotiating power. So the PBMs basically control the prices almost completely for drugs. And they see and nobody, you know, there's only three of them. And nobody's, and they're kind of behind the scenes. Nobody knows what they're doing. They are one of the biggest, big holes in the system that it's really hard to figure out what's going on.
Three pharmacy benefit managers?
Right. So, three of them. So basically three wholesalers, like the drug companies that actually produce the drugs, there's 80% of the drugs come from about the big 10, but there's also dozens of these little ones that produce one little drug here or there, things of that sort. But they all go through the PBMs in between the drug manufacturers and the hospitals, the insurance companies, and the pharmacies.
Why do the drug manufacturers want to go through the PBMs and not deal directly with the hospitals and what have you?
Well, that's a good question. I tell you from the insurance company's point of view, is that there's so many of them that they can't really, you know, even a company like Blue Cross can't negotiate with 100 different of these pharmacies. And so the wholesalers have developed. And now that they're into that, they can't get out of it. And I think the pharmaceutical manufacturers are benefiting from this because they can't concentrate on any one of them. But that's an area that I've been trying to study, and I find it enormously even hard to understand.
Would it be accurate to say these pharmacy benefit managers is like a big old black hole between
exactly.
The drug manufacturers?
Perfect description.
Money laundering, however you want to phrase it.
They do a lot of kind of really strange things because, of course, what the actual patient is concerned about is their out-of-pocket expense. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes that's a percentage or whatever. But then these PBMs play these games where they'll send a voucher to the patient that says, okay, well, I'm going to reduce your payment to only $5. Mm-hmm. Okay, so instead of being 20% of $100, being $20, they say, I'm going to only be $5, but they still charge the insurance company the full $100. Mm-hmm. And so, because the insurance companies can't negotiate with that. So they're getting people in to buy the drugs, and they're getting the full price, and the people say, oh, it's okay, because I'm only paying $5. So they play all these kind of amazing games, and then they also, you know, you need to get some of the pharmacists to come in and talk about what their perspective is. But it is a big black hole.
So if the government were to really seriously want to do anything about prescription drug prices, they would have to have the desire to dig into what these pharmacy benefit managers are doing. Accurate or not?
They can do something directly. Like, for instance, that's what the Biden administration did do to say is to let Medicare, when they buy drugs, to negotiate with the pharmacies. Okay, and as far as I know, they're bypassing the PBMs on those drugs.
But just certain drugs,
now,
right?
Yes, but that's right now. It's only like a dozen drugs, right. Some of the big high cost ones. But they're supposedly going to be expanding that process over time. But other countries, have just set the prices for the drugs. Everybody else in the world sets the prices for the drug. We're the only ones where the drug companies through the PBMs can charge anything they want. There's a process called reference pricing that all the European and Canada uses, which is why they pay half or less for the drugs than what we pay.
Dub, we're going to have to leave it here for now while our eyes are glazed over, and I'm going to have to get a prescription to deal with whatever it is that I have now after talking about this with you. It is.
I'm so sorry.
No. You did a great job. You did a great job. It's not you. It's just the situation, and it just seems like you got this big black hole. Somebody's making a lot of money, and whenever there's money, yes, there's power and influence, and that's what we're talking about. Yes.
Well, and the pharmaceutical companies are making a lot of money.
Yep. Thank you, Dub.
Okay.
Appreciate it as always. Have a good day out at UNO. Walter Dub Lane, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at UNO. We're going to take a break, come back, talk with Holly Cosell. Speaking of healthcare, credentialed NBA writer covering the Pelicans. They opened with a win last night against the Chicago Bulls. But there were some health implications. We'll talk about that when we return. 940, 20 till 10, traffic now, WWL. There we go. 9:46 now, 14 till 9. The Pelicans beat the Bulls last night, but at what cost? Holly Cosell joins now, credentialed NBA writer covering the Pelicans. How you doing, Holly?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm doing well. And yeah, you're absolutely right. At what cost? Because it was a mixed bag. You get a win, but you lose an important player.
Tell me your thoughts on the, first of all, Zion. What do you know about him?
Well, Zion picked up an illness several days ago. And it didn't look like he was going to play yesterday. Sure enough, he did not. But from what I'm hearing, he's going to be able to make that trip. Pelicans are going off on a 4-game road trip starting tomorrow in Portland, and that he should probably be available. So that's the good positive there.
Tell me about DeJon Murray. What do we know about him?
Yeah, unfortunately, he was on his way.
Murray. What did I say? DeJounte Murray.
Yeah, DeJounte. Trust me, we've all done it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was on his way to a nice game, triple-double. Wasn't shooting the ball well, but you could tell the offense was flowing much better with him at the controls. And defensively, I thought he did a decent job of slowing down Zach LaVine, who was incredibly hot for the Bulls in the first half. And it looked like he went up on a jump shot late, landed wrong, where he was trying to brace himself with his left hand and apparently fractured his left hand. Looks like he's probably going to be out for 3 to 6 weeks. Of course, we won't know for certain until we know what kind of fracture it was.
Hang on one second while I beat my head against the microphone. Holly, hang on while I beat my head against the microphone. Can you please?
Okay. Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah.
I mean, look, would it be a Pelican season if we weren't talking about injuries in the first week, right? I mean, I had all the Saints fans trying to console me with that.
But it's just, man, you know, man.
Yeah, it's awful news because DeJounte has been actually a model, durable type of player, especially while he was in Atlanta. So for him just to go out like that in the first game, when you're already missing Trey Murphy, now the Pelicans will be out, what, with two of their best six players, Tommy? Yeah, it's just not conducive to getting to a great, off to a great start.
Thoughts about the rest of the help from the Pelicans bench, et cetera?
I'm sorry, say that again, Tommy.
Thoughts about the help from the Pelicans bench, et cetera, and the whole small ball concept?
The bench was incredible. Yeah, look, last year that was one of their biggest strengths, but after losing Dyson Daniels and Larry Nance this past offseason and several other guys, you were worried that maybe this team wouldn't have that kind of support from the reserves. But, no, Eve Missy, I mean, let's start there. Pelicans rookie draft pick, 21st from the last draft. Nobody expected for him to be able to contribute right away because he's a raw basketball player. You saw that with his lone year in Baylor, and he's a guy that just started playing basketball, Tommy, at age 15. He's now 20. But you wouldn't believe that he played 23 minutes, only picked up 2 fouls, and I thought he was crucial in changing the momentum of the game, where the Bulls, not only were they hitting threes, they were getting a lot of layups. But he came in, started erasing some shots, and before you know it, the Pelicans were the ones now creating the turnovers and running up the score on their opponent by getting to the rim. So Eve Missy, stellar debut. And then, of course, you had Jordan Hawkins, who was probably the Pelicans' best player in preseason. He got off to a quick start, hit a couple of shots. And you got to give credit to a guy like Devontae Green. I think we've even talked about him on your show before. Mm-hmm. Somebody was going to have to fill that role of Najee Marshall, Dyson Daniels, one of the wings that's going to be Willie's best defender off the bench. And it looks like with his 4 steals, Javonte Green's well on his way to doing that.
So looking ahead, how do you see this playing out with the injury to DeJounte Murray and, I guess, Zion will be back? I don't exactly know what's wrong with him, but.
Yeah, Zion just had a viral infection, okay, right? So he was always going to miss probably just one game. So he's going to jump right into the lineup. And essentially, Tommy, what we're going to have is what we saw last year, right? CJ's going to roll over to a point guard position, but he's not going to be the de facto point guard. most of the ball initiation right for the offense will come from Brandon Ingram and Zion Williamson. And you simply have Daniel Tice replacing Jonas Valanciunas from last season. So it's kind of almost, I don't know if it's funny to say, but yeah, the Pelicans are going to be doing what they tried to get away from this offseason, right? They wanted to go small, get away from playing a traditional big and not having a legitimate point guard on the floor. Well, they're going to be back to that, it looks like, for probably at least several weeks. Like I said, I think 3 to 6 weeks is what I'm guessing Murray's going to be out.
Next up, they play Portland. How do they match up against the Trailblazers?
Well, you got to like the matchup. It's another young team, inexperienced, not expected to do well this year. So if the Pelicans, who have, you know, multitude of weapons, right? So we're talking about two guys that are out, but if they get Zion back, they'll still have four legitimate 20-point scorers. So they have enough offense. And you saw the defense yesterday. Still looked a lot like the defense we saw the last couple of seasons. So you expect them to do well, right? Portland last in the Western Conference standings last season. They aren't expected to improve much. So I expect them to honestly fetch two wins if they play decently.
And you said with DeJounte Murray, 4 to 6 weeks, is that what you said?
Yeah, the usual expectation is when you fracture a left hand, and this is not with surgery, right? If surgery is required, it may take a little bit more. But the standard time is usually 3 to 6 weeks.
All right. Thank you, Ali. It's just frustrating.
I mean, I went through a little more joyful, right? They got off to a nice start yesterday.
No, I know. I understand. I get all of that, but we're all excited about DeJounte Murray and man,
yeah.
We talked about beforehand about Zion, and I understand he's coming back. It was just a viral thing, but it was just kind of a deflating thing almost. You know what I'm saying? I know they won, and we should all be happy that they won and that they'll probably beat Portland, but it's just, you know what I'm saying.
It's never a perfect situation. I looked around the league. There was at least three or four other injuries, right? So it's not just the Pelicans, but yeah, it feels like it. I know.
You know what? That's right. It's never a perfect situation. Words to close on. Thank you, Ollie.
We'll talk to you again soon. Have a good weekend.
You too, man. Ali Kosel, credentialed NBA writer covering the Pelicans. Newell is taking his show on the road. We'll talk about it when we come back here on WWL.